Are you looking for an environmentally safe organic fertilizer that will give you fantastic results in your garden this season? Neptune's Harvest manufactures a top-of-the-line, highly concentrated, cold-processed, hydrolyzed fish fertilizer. It's made from the 60 to 70% of the fish that's left over after the fillet has been removed to be sold as seafood.
All the fish are caught offshore in the cold, clean, dark, mineral-rich North Atlantic ocean water off the coast of New England. It contains all the nutrients that plants and soil need to stay healthy in nature's perfect balance. It will increase the soil quality, the yield and quality of all crops, making whatever you grow more nutrient-dense and better able to withstand stress, disease, and insect damage.
Neptune's Harvest is a great food source for microbes and beneficial bacteria, increasing the organic matter in the soil so that it drains better, retains moisture, and sequesters carbon. It's also a great deer repellent. To learn more about all their amazing organic fertilizers, go to neptunesharvest.com and use the code GOODDIRT for 5% off your order. That's GOODDIRT for 5% off your order.
Fast Forward Productions, The Women Are Speaking.
There's nobody to say, hey, that's going to screw the land, because the company that's using those commodity inputs actually has no idea where it came from. And that's the thing that always would boggle my mind, is a company saying, we're not going to source from the Brazilian Amazon because of deforestation. But if it's a commodity crop, you generally have no idea where that's coming from.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now. The farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
Welcome back to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is the second part of the two-part conversation that we started last week with Danielle Schwab, who is the creator of Illuminate Food, which is a weekly newsletter about how we can better understand our food system and eat for the future. So we started this conversation last week in part one. If you haven't listened yet, we recommend that you go back and then come back here to hear part two.
Yes. And in the first of this two-part episode, we heard about Danielle's background and her journey with her farm box delivery service. We discussed the complexity of the challenges in both local and commodity scale production and the importance of consumer choices in driving change.
So that was last week. In today's episode, which is part two, we talk a bit more about the role of policy and bigger institutions in shaping general food choices of the public, how essential transparency in supply chains is, and our knowledge of supply chains is to address the negative impacts of larger commodity crops like corn and soybeans. And we also talked about the benefits and challenges of transitioning to plant-based diets. So lots to get into here. We also talk a good bit about beans, which are a great sustainable food source. And Danielle is a huge fan of beans. And I have, since this conversation, also gotten really into beans. So that's fun.
Me too.
Yeah. So enjoy the second part of this two-part episode and let us know what you think. What do you think in your work with, because you were in the big corporate world and then you were not, and now you're back sort of around it. What do you think about the responsibility of the consumer and educating yourself and educating the consumer. What do you think about from a policy level, like for these big companies, what kind of solutions are there? Like sometimes I feel like there's just no hope if we rely on people's individual choices. Like as much of an optimist I like to be, like you can make a difference with your dollar, I feel like we don't actually have that kind of power. So then that leads me to like, well, it's these companies' responsibility and they're only going to do their best interest. So then it's like, is it like regulation? Is it policy? I don't know. What is your stance on that? Like can policy fix some of this stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm here to tell you, there is optimism in this space, actually. And that's why I do like the job I'm currently doing, which is food service, because food service does offer that power to present a menu or a buffet with plant-based or vegetable-forward dishes ahead or on par with the meat dishes. I mean, we are such a meat and potatoes country that to me is what is a fascinating space to watch right now. Because if you go to a menu or a restaurant and you see all animal proteins and then one like cauliflower steak at the bottom, that's not going to catch your eye. But if that place has some motivation, we can talk about where that motivation might come from, to really put that cauliflower steak on the top and make it the most attractive, innovative dish on their menu, that's a complete game changer for someone's brain. It's like, well, I'm not skipping out on all these incredible dishes to get this kind of like sad veggie dish. I'm actually getting their recommended dish, whatever that may be. So that is what I see happening in food service. I see it happening in hospitals, and that's a policy angle. Like New York City has some really impressive plant-based goals. So right now in hospitals, they offer to the patients plant-based meals first. Oh, do you want to try this mushroom jerky sandwich? No. Do you want to try this cauliflower chickpea curry? No. Then they would offer a meat dish. So that's like a really incredible way to make change without forcing it on someone, just offering really good food. So I see the motivation is coming from different places, but it is there. And, you know, we work with some colleges and universities, like these sustainability goals, though they may be vague and in the distance, there are people, a lot of people whose full-time job is getting those in motion, and it's slow, but it's happening. So like any sustainability goal at like a, we call them a GPO, a group purchasing organization, which is like a Sodexo or a Compass who kind of prepare food at large scale for institutions. Those organizations have really impressive sustainability goals. They're definitely worth looking at and they can't sleep on them. Like they have to take action. And they know what they need to do. They need to substitute more plant-forward dishes for meat, and they need to source more locally, and they are the ones who make the food happen in institutions. So I do see a lot of momentum. It is slow, decades in the making, but I see more momentum there than I see for at home. So the idea that that can have a ripple effect to somebody's home choices is what's unknown. It's like, oh, they made me eat plant-based at school today, so I'm going to come home and eat it meat. Well, either way, that's 50% cut in half. And from stats I see out there, it doesn't have to be zero. It really doesn't have to be zero. So I see a lot of hopeful progress in that space because it's like so obvious now what needs to happen. So the momentum is there.
So a couple of questions. And this is really like curiosity on my point. First of all, can you get on the climate beneficial meat bandwagon and speak to that a little bit? And then also, this is the question I have really, and I don't know where I even land on this, because I want to talk to people that work in this space that can answer the question, is if as an entire culture, let's just say we suddenly went plant-based or, you know, 80-20 plants, does that not put a lot of pressure on the system to create monocultures and problem crops? You know, you're talking about, and this might get us back to the soybean thing, you know, the grain, the corn, and the soybeans to support the movement towards plant-based. And I'm just really curious about that. Like, does that not, and when you're considering the nutrition density of meat versus plants, which are very, very nutritious, but just takes more. It's more. The volume's got to be more. The combination of foods to get your complete proteins has got to be more. So what kind of pressure does that put on the system and our soil? and the industry for inputs and that kind of thing. So, I'd love to hear you talk about that.
Sure. Well, the first one, so on the kind of regenerative, you know, sustainable, climate-friendly beef, I meet a lot of people who want to get into that discussion in terms of like, oh, it's good for the soil and the ground and the rotation and all of that. Absolutely. And this is where my kind of food systems zoomed out perspective just trumps that, because if you live somewhere and can get that type of meat and want to support that, that is awesome. I have zero problem with that. That to me is, you know, in a completely different universe than the CAFOs.
Yeah. And my thought is like, when you mentioned the hospital, like the hospitals are not purchasing regenerative.
No.
So like if you're in a hospital, yes, the better option is going to be the plant one. Even,
yeah. It can be hard in this kind of like sustainable food movement bubble. It often errs on the side of like, there is a lot of support and respect for regenerative ranching, kiss the ground, all of that stuff. But I think that is leaving out the food system impacts. And for kind of an average consumer, another easy way to just be like, oh, well, they're figuring it out with that. Like meat's going to be fine. We'll all do crop rotation and regenerative grazing, which we all know there's not enough land for that, for the amount of meat that we eat. Even if that's happening in the U.S., really easy to only think about the US. What about China and their growing meat intake? Like it just doesn't translate. So to me, it's apples and oranges. I will never tell someone not to eat meat, but you know, it's just not getting the systemic issues, which I think your second question about we change to eat, kind of the problem we had with quinoa, this idea that like something blows up and then the whole supply chain gets screwed over the small holder farmers. There's always kind of an adverse effect, which is part of this innovation leads to destruction. Anytime we kind of like overhype someone, something, and don't bring in the human and environmental impact, it's going to keep happening. So what I hope for this period of time is that companies are bringing more transparency to their supply chains and having more vertical integration where they know their inputs, so that this type of over-farming exploitation of humans and the environment won't be happening, because the commodity system is what allows this level of exploitation. It's the tragedy of the commons. There's nobody to say, hey, that's going to screw the land. Hey, that's exploiting the people, because the company that's using those commodity inputs actually has no idea where it came from because it's a commodity. And that's the thing that always would boggle my mind, is a company saying, oh, we're going to source XYZ, or we're not going to source from the Brazilian Amazon because of deforestation. But if it's a commodity crop, you generally have no idea where that's coming from. Or we're going to change like General Mills, we're going to change to be regenerative. That supply chain doesn't exist right now. So there's a lot of talk around sourcing, but in a commodity system, that doesn't actually work. So as companies put two and two together, and I think Pepsi is actually a pretty good example. They've done some really interesting vertically integrated supply chain work where they know their growers. So they actually can say, we're going to invest X amount of million dollars in our smallholder farms to take care of their soil that will trickle down into our supply chain, which certain companies realize that's actually a strategic security investment for them to have farms that can operate for another 50, 100 years, as opposed to the commodity model, which just kicks out farms whose soil becomes untenable. So I think this recognition that we have to see the whole thing through, that we have to know, you know, what is from deforestation in the Amazon. There's a ton of pressure around that right now. That translates into real action. There's the EU has very strict requirements around sourcing and importing and everything around minerals and the mines for our phones. Like there is that pressure on, we just can't take from wherever and put it in our food or our things and pretend we didn't know. So that change will prevent us from going down this same rabbit hole as we transition the food system to just screwing over an entire other crop or farmers or whoever's growing it, because they'll actually have to know, okay, this amaranth or this millet or this barley came from here, and we need to respect that land and these people and have that strategic viewpoint of how the whole thing works.
So what is the issue with soybeans getting too big? I want to know for myself.
I think there's a bunch of issues. So right now, for example, Fable has soy protein in the product. It has 3% because the mushroom meat that I work for.
Okay.
Yeah. So right now, a lot of plant-based meats, they all use an emulsifier. It's like a binder to hold everything together. So Impossible, I don't want to misquote, but Believe It's Impossible uses something called methyl cellulose, which is a derivative of cellulose. And it's not easily digested by our bodies, but that's the binder to hold things together. And that has been controversial. Our product, on the other hand, uses soy. But again and again, I'm getting feedback like, oh, we don't use soy, soy-free, soy is bad. So I've also been thinking about this a lot, because at the same time that soy is like everywhere and feeding the animals that we eat, it's also starting to get uncool in the US, I believe, because people associate it with like GMOs.
And like the oils?
Some of that. And then there's some of this kind of like conservative argument around estrogen and not being a manly man if you're drinking soy milk. And there's a great episode on Maintenance Phase, the podcast, that goes into this kind of connection between soy and conservatism. And it's a little bit dark place that is happening, but it's a little silly to me because there's this bad reputation while at the same time being omnipresent in our food. So it's almost like this idea of like, oh, we can't have sugar while everyone's drinking high fructose corn syrup. A little misguided, in my opinion. Soy in general, I mean, fascinates me because it's like, okay, maybe edamame, but no one really knows when they're eating soy or what the plant looks like or what it is or what it tastes like. It's just so disconnected because it's like an ingredient. It's just like plastic. It's kind of just used as this material to make textures and make flavors and be a vehicle and all of that. There is a world in which soy, as it historically was used, is a crop that has flavor, is nutritious, is good for the soil. It is, which is why it was taken out of China. And, you know, reading back in some of that history, that's the genius to it. Oh my God, look at this crop. It's so easy to grow. It's so resilient. It's so nutritious. It has all these parts, the pod, the oil, the whole thing. We're going to take it here and we're going to grow it. And that's what happens. So we grow millions and millions of acres of soy. I believe I said it was the second largest crop in the US, but it's unclear what happens to all of it. Some of it's in our gasoline, the biodiesel. It's just become this omnipresent thing. So I think it's an interesting time for soy because as we discussed, there's the conversation among consumers, quote unquote, educated consumers. And then there's the kind of the way the system's actually working conversation that involves the import and export of soy from the countries where it's the cheapest. And that's how it works. So I don't know where that's going. I don't, you know, have an opinion on if I think we should be eating more soy or what, but I wish it wouldn't get so kind of vilified before we really address its role in the food system. And if there is a world in which respecting soy can actually help balance out some of the meat. And I think this idea that like, oh, soy is bad, we never think about, oh, is meat bad? I mean, meat's literally listed, red meat, as like a carcinogen by like the World Health Organization. But like, that's pretty easily dismissed. But it's like, oh, soy is bad. So I just think it's interesting how these conversations get kind of like seeped into the cultural conversation without a lot of depth with them, as we've said. And this is what's scary about social media. And it's really easy to just hire someone to write a piece, as there's been every industry will do to protect itself, to kind of get people scared or freaked out by something to prevent change.
If you're planting flowers, vegetables, shrubs, or just trying to keep your lawn healthy and green, then you should know about Neptune's Harvest. Neptune's Harvest fertilizers come from the mineral-rich North Atlantic Ocean, which contains all the nutrients that plants and soil need.
Flower growers, get your sunglasses out. You'll want to use them when you're looking at how bright those colors are. Vegetable growers, with Neptune's Harvest, you can achieve the amazing results you deserve for all your efforts with the most abundant, sweet-tasting supply of organically grown produce. And you know, there's nothing like the taste of a fresh garden tomato you grew yourself. Neptune's Harvest works great, whether you know what you're doing or not. You'll look good and you'll feel good because you're doing the right thing for the environment and your health.
Try Neptune's Harvest, products from the ocean to set your plants in motion. Available at neptunesharvest.com. Use the code GOODDIRT at checkout for 5% off your order. That's GOODDIRT.
I love the idea of respecting something as a way to maybe balance it out
Yeah.
But that does bring me to my other obsession, which is beans. And I write about them all the time. And that's kind of been one of my solutions to this all is like, there are ways to eat protein and have a kind of center of your plate ingredient and have it not be meat. And beans is somewhere I've landed as one of these catch-all win-win-wins. And it's beans to me have been that symbol of like, there's something else we can eat and respect and train ourselves to cook and enjoy and shift our plates as a bellwether for the food system. So that's been my little project for myself is eating more beans and getting excited about beans. And they're like kind of a joke right now. It's like, oh, anybody who's talking about beans is talking about gas or like, you know, silly stuff. And it's like, to me, that's a waste. It's like beans are a huge food group with a high amount of protein with so much variety, they're just not really in the conversation. So that is something I see as really interesting, way more interesting than a plant-based meat. Obviously, I love the mushroom meat as well, but that's a big puzzle piece for me is beans and getting people excited about them and willing and curious enough to eat a dinner with beans, not with chicken, just with itself.
And another piece of that I'll add is it's one area where there are a lot of options for locally, organically, and sustainably grown, unlike the soy and the grains and so forth, the commodity things, to your point, you don't know where they came from. It's just all pulled together and sold. But you can find local beans, you can find local legumes, and it's so true. And they're a lot of fun, and they're such a huge variety, such wide variety, I should say, in types and flavors. And so, yeah, I get that. It's refreshing to be able to zone in on something that's kind of not set in the collective mindset as good or bad or this or that. It's kind of a fresh way of looking at things, I think. You know what I mean? It's something new to explore that hasn't been layered with all kinds of assumptions.
Yeah. It's the answer. It's the one thing.
That's where we get in trouble.
There's a big campaign called Beans is How.
Oh,
they're probably a small group. It's a hashtag. It's very sweet. People in that world, you know, they really believe because they're nitrogen fixers, you know, and there is a lot going on there. So I think that to me, it's not going to solve all the problems, of course. But I do think, just as you said, there's commodity level beans in the can, which are of a certain quality. And then there's, you know, more local, a little more expensive beans. And that's just everybody's personal journey. But I think spending a little more time there is really important in how to get people interested or intrigued.
I really love, like, I love and appreciate this conversation so much because I think that we don't recognize on this podcast, even in the circles that we talk, we don't recognize enough how different the conversations are between the option to buy regenerative meat and eat your heritage beans and do your CSA and what that's like versus, like, that's one conversation. And then there is food systems and policy and what the institutions for the hospitals and the schools and literally a majority of the population, how they're being fed and how we are sustaining ourselves and what's available. And they're just different conversations. I think that it's so easy to get on one certain bandwagon and one certain thing. And I think it leads to a lot of unproductive conflict and also not just conflict, but like a resistance to like thinking about things differently that is just not helping anyone. So I really appreciate this conversation for reminding me of that like context is everything, really.
Yeah. And that's why I was so grateful, you know, you all reached out, because I think a lot of the local food and sustainable food conversations are mostly talking about those things in the silo. And it's hard to fit in those system level, supply chain level conversations, because it's like a mismatch a little bit. So it has been hard to figure out, you know, where does my voice come in? Am I a food writer? Am I a global economics writer? Like, I don't know. So it's just been interesting to see, you know, where does it resonate? And food media and food social media is so beautiful right now. It's like all about the visuals. And it's like, I mean, this is one of the sillier things I've done, but I get so much cake content because it's so stunning, beautifully decorated cakes. That last week, I just wanted to try making a savory cake because I want to make those designs and I want to make something beautiful. So I had seen there's like a Swedish savory cake. I won't be able to pronounce it, but they use like rye bread and smoked salmon and cream cheese and make this like beautiful cake. So I made one that was like, it was beans as the filling and cream cheese. And then I had like creme fraiche decoration and I had like a little tomato heart and beet. And it was just so fun. And it was exactly what I felt I want to see more of. It's like, how do we take innovative, interesting ingredients and bring them into this like food media bubble of like, everything's beautiful, everything's delicious, everything's perfect. So that was fun. You know, does it fall on deaf ears? Who knows? Who cares? It was exciting to be able to create something what I see is only with sugar, only with butter, only with frosting and kind of turn it on its head.
Danielle, I'm afraid you're a visionary and people aren't going to catch up to you. You're just on a different plane.
You know, before we go into our last couple of questions, I want to say, I think to me, what I'm taking away from this conversation is like, we're just asking people or inviting people, I would say, anybody that's interested in food and our food system and the climate crisis and all these issues around food, which is common to every human on the planet, whether or not you think about it. It's just invite people to go deeper with it. Just go deeper. Just don't like look at the food related things that show up on your feed and that are going to affirm your current beliefs. You know, allow yourself to go to other threads and look and see what they're saying. And you don't have to agree or disagree. Just allow yourself to be exposed to a lot of different ideas and information.
Yeah. And I guess trust yourself too, to kind of like make decisions for yourself and not necessarily, we all want to be told what we like should and shouldn't. It's easier just, oh, I like them and what they're doing. So what they tell me what to do, I don't know. But I think that there's so much, I think someone like you who has the like bravery to be like, this is a silly example with the cake, but just be like, I'm going to make this cake this way because that makes me happy. Yeah. With salmon, in a way, the more of us that can think that way of being, well, because you can't care about everything, right? You know, you pick your things that you're going to really care about. And if we're all sort of doing that in our own way, that was a little optimistic of me, but maybe that's a step in the right direction, as opposed to just taking the sound bites that we think we should or shouldn't, and then ignoring the nuance.
Yeah, no, I get it. I get it. Like, you know, don't create your entire lifestyle and ethos around some sound bite that's going around social media.
Yeah. You know, the other person, you know, the other shout out I want to make for like what this is going to take is a lot of us are making food for other people that we live with at home. And I think to make something new or to experiment, it really relies on those other people being open-minded and kind as well, because it's a lot of pressure if you're the person making dinner in your household. I am. It's just the two of us. But it's like, it is a lot of pressure. You don't want to feed someone something gross or hard beans or like something you tried and it's going to fail. Like that's sucks. It does take the kind of willingness and support of all the eaters at the table to be like, okay, I know that steak and potatoes is a delicious meal, but if you try something different, I'm going to support and try and not give you a hard time. And I think that is harder when you have kids at the table. I don't right now, but you know, serving chicken nuggets, like I get it. So that at home dinner table, putting something different out there and how that goes is going to result in somebody giving it another try or just going back to resort to kind of the favorites. So that to me is like a really sensitive ask. And I think that's what I appreciate. My partner kind of gives me that space to play a little bit. And there has been times where the beans are hard or it just didn't work or whatever happened. But that's what I need to be able to play a little bit and to figure out what else there is than kind of the animal protein, vegetable and starch.
Yeah, that's so true. Lady Farmer and the Good Dirt, we like to kind of center all of our conversations around, you know, slow food, slow fashion, and slow living is the term that we use. And so we like to ask all of our guests, what does slow living mean to you? And if it's something that you do, how you're able to do it in your daily life?
Yes. So I did write this one down because I didn't want to forget it. So slow living to me is not seeing cooking as a chore. That's kind of what keeps coming up for me, and seeing it as an opportunity to really slow down and examine, investigate, get to know these ingredients, smell them, taste them, look at them, take that as the time to connect to your food food. I think in my whole last year of cooking, it was like, I'm just going to put on a podcast, or I'm going to like try and double task or put something in the oven and go run away. And it's like, that was my go-to because we're all trying to do so much. But now I really try and use that to be in the moment with the food. That's really been my connection to slow living in the past year.
Oh, that's so true and such an inspiration. It's paradigm shifting to think about it as, because obviously we all have to do it. So yeah, sure, it can fall in the chore category, and it does. And for many of us, in the way that our lives are set up, it truly is. But what if we give it space and permission to not be, and to let it be a pleasure and an opportunity? Really cool.
This would be my hot tip. I mean, meal planning, if you can, of course. Yeah. But cooking, if you can carve out an hour in the morning instead of the 5 to 6 hour, the light that you'll get in your kitchen will kind of change the game. And it might make you want to take a photo, which you then might post to get someone else inspired. But if I cook at 5 or 6, it's like, oh, especially in the winter, it's like dark and it's like, just want to get it over with. I want to sit down. So cooking in the morning, even though, you know, you might have to reheat it later, is the way that I've been able to not only record some beautiful content in the light, but just get a little more engaged because of the light and the time.
Your mental state.
So it seems kind of backwards, but most food content creators are cooking in the day and they reheat it later. And I think that's just been something that even if I'm not creating content, if I can do it in the morning.
That's such a good tip. We also have another person on here we've had a couple of times. She's like the goddess of slow cooker meals, doing that to help you slow down in the day. And she's like, I mean, obviously, slow cooking. So you have to do it in the morning.
And I love what you said about the light. And that's so true in my life because my kitchen has eastern exposure and it has beautiful light in the morning. And it's just delightful and happy place to be. But 5 o'clock, it is dark. And especially now it is cold. I kind of don't want to go in there. And then in the summer, at 5 o'clock, it's still pretty outside, but the kitchen's still kind of dark. So I don't want to be in there then either. So that is so true for me, is to do my food prep in the morning. Absolutely. Game changer. Put on the soup. I'm famous for putting on the soup early in the day. That's my go-to. Okay. So the last question we'll ask you today is what does the good dirt mean to you?
And it doesn't mean the podcast.
Just the concept of good dirt, the good dirt.
Yeah, I was thinking about it. And I think, I mean, obviously trying to be literal with the dirt, it's kind of like comes up as not being scared of the outdoors. But I think what that really means to me is like stepping out of comfort living. I think we're all just probably many of your listeners, just so we're privileged to kind of be living these comfortable lives with so much access to all the things and our temperatures and our coziness and everything that we have. And I think being able to dip your toes in the water of a little less convenient is really something that is hard and can be very rewarding. And that's kind of what it means to me, is getting your hands dirty, but not just for fun, but more as like a challenge, and being out in the cold, getting wet. And I think that's why I live by the ocean. And when people do the dips in the ocean, it's like that mental game of like, yeah, I don't want to do this, but like that challenge. So there's all sorts of ways that we can kind of push ourselves.
I love that one.
That's great. There's a lot of life in the good dirt.
Yeah, it's not the good, like, cozy comfy.
Not always. Yeah. But cozy comfy is always there.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's often cozier when you come back.
Yes, that's true.
Right.
So as we wrap up, is there anything else that you want the audience to understand about the work that you're doing and what you're currently putting out there?
I don't think so. I would love to have people interested, you know, come sign up for my Substack. And I think there's so much content out there. It's very hard to read new stuff and follow and try new things. And I think any engagement or anything someone might read, like, that's amazing. Like, I think we're all just trying to stay on the treadmill. So, you know, leaving with people, if they want to buy dry beans that are from smaller scale producers, like Primary Beans or Rancho Gordo are kind of my go-tos. That to me is like a huge leap if somebody wants to give that a try. So yeah, thank you. Thanks everyone for listening.
Yeah. And remind folks, what is the name of your Substack? And are you on Instagram? And can people follow you there?
Yes, I'm Illuminate Food on both. So illuminate-food.com is my website, and you can find my Substack there. And then it's Illuminate_food on Instagram. And that word to me is just so powerful about shining light. I think that's exactly what this conversation has been.
Yes, exactly. I feel the same way. It's just like talking about things, getting them out in the open and getting people to think a little deeper, as we've been saying. I love it. Wonderful. Thank you for your time. It was delightful.
Very nice to meet you both. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning in, calling in, and spreading the good dirt. We love hearing from you. You can reach our listener voicemail at 443-459-1950. That's 443-459-1950. You can find this number in our show notes and in our Instagram profile.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at We Are Lady Farmer. That's We Are Lady Farmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on The Good Dirt.
Goodbye.